Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. Today, we're talking about one of science's favorite pastimes, being spectacularly wrong about who's actually right.
Our guest this morning is science journalist and storyteller Matt Kaplan, whose forthcoming book is provocatively titled, I Told You So, with an exclamation point at the end that feels very earned. The book explores the scientists who saw the truth early and paid dearly for it. We're talking about researchers who were mocked, sidelined, exiled, and even imprisoned, not for bad science, but for being ahead of it.
From ideas that threatened religious doctrine to discoveries that upended political power or scientific orthodoxy, these are stories of brilliance colliding with human ego, fear, and institutional inertia. And they raise a timely question. How many revolutionary ideas today are being laughed out of the room or even out of town?
Matt brings history's most misunderstood scientists back into the spotlight with wit, empathy, and a sharp eye for the lessons we keep refusing to learn. Matt Kaplan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn and Scott, thank you so much for having me.
It's really great to have you. And what a fun and educational book this is. And that is Galileo on the cover of your book. Is that correct?
You know, actually, it is not stated who that is. In my mind's eye, I think that's Galileo. And actually, the finger he's holding up is the middle one. But, you know, it's not explicit. But Galileo's, you know, when I set off to do all of this stuff and write this, Galileo was forefront in my mind because, I mean, really, this book came into being during the pandemic. I was talking to researchers and I was having folks say to me, oh, that idea I just told you about how we could better treat COVID. Yeah, you can't say that. And I would say, well, why not? And they would say, well, because I'm a PhD student and my research supervisor really doesn't agree with my opinion. And if you publish that, I could get fired. Or you can't publish what I just told you because there's no funding for it. And people just laugh at me for saying it and might as well just leave it alone. Or my personal favorite, Matt, let's face it, this is immunology and I'm a woman. And, you know, not publishing that. So, I was stuck at home, homeschooling a 4-year-old and asking myself, has science always been behaving like this? And the answer is yes. Yes, it has.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible your experience during COVID to know the frustration and the I can't believe you're saying this to me now sort of responses that you must have had. So was that the genesis for the book? And then is that the launching pad from which you began and then went back to Galileo, for example?
Yeah. So it's really interesting because I don't want to say that COVID-19 was the moment of revelation that this is how science functioned, because I've been a science correspondent at The Economist for 20 years. So it's not like suddenly science started behaving differently in 2019 and 2020. Far from it. I mean, absolutely. I had seen this kind of behavior before. And actually, my book starts with a conference that I was at in like 2012, 2013, where there was a female PhD student revealing findings from an experiment that she had run that was raising questions about a lot of stuff that people had been doing in paleontology for a number of years. It's hard to go from COVID-19 to paleontology, but I'm a paleoclimatologist by training. And so that was my beat back in 2012 at The Economist. And people had been putting pictures of dinosaurs with colored feathers on their, you know, in journal articles. And it was getting a lot of attention. And this PhD student said, well, wait a minute. We're saying that we know what color a dinosaur was because we look in the fossil record at the impressions of feathers and say we can see pigment molecules called melanosomes in the feather, and we know which pigment molecule correlates to which color, so we know T-Rex was green. And so therefore they create this beautiful picture of a parrot-like T-Rex and publish it on a journal. They get a lot of money and funding and all kind of, and research, and of course they go up in terms of their gravitas in the academic community, so that this PhD student was publishing a poster in the evening at the conference and saying, I buried feathers in my garden for a year under different conditions, and I dug them up. And I went to go and look and see if I can see melanosomes, these pigment molecules. And I can't tell the difference between a pigment molecule and a bacteria under the microscope. And they've been buried for 1 year. Are we sure that we are looking at color molecules here? And so you had, I had just come in from eating supper and I was on the conference room floor and I suddenly started hearing screaming, swearing. And I turned a corner to find this group of, I mean, like 7, 8 angry old white men shouting at this 20-something female PhD student. And I thought, are you kidding me? Like, they were using terms like female genitalia to refer to her. Really nasty, nasty, bitterly vicious language. And so I knew that science had its issues way back when. But then when COVID, I mean, people were dying, right? So how are we having this conversation? You've got ideas and we can't publish it or even talk about it because of this or this reason, with my favorite being, Matt, this is immunology and I'm a woman. And, you know, your idea could be the idea that solves the pandemic. And in fact, I talk about Kati Kariko, the Hungarian Nobel laureate who was demoted, fired, and threatened with deportation from the United States of America for developing the mRNA technique that paved the way for the COVID vaccine. And I mean, she was this close to just saying, screw all of this, I'm going to go be a florist for the rest of my life. I mean, I don't know if she likes floristry or not. Maybe dental hygienistry was going to be her thing. But I mean, like just saying, I'm done with this. And that's what happened to this PhD student who I talk about in 2012. You know, Kati Kariko was a near miss. We're lucky that she had the tenacity to put up with all the BS. And so I go into history. I look at the history of science and say, you know, how long has this been going on and what can we do to make it better?
Your passion about this subject is absolutely undeniable right now. And I have to say that when I think about this, of course, I think about Galileo. He's kind of the GOAT, the greatest of all time. We think of in terms of being persecuted for his theories and ideas. And many of these scientists weren't just ignored. They were actually ridiculed, exiled, imprisoned. What do these extreme reactions actually tell us about how institutions are responding to disruptive ideas, not just back then, but currently?
Well, I think that the key word in there is, how are institutions responding? And actually, I don't think in most cases it's the institution responding. We like to think of science as dispassionate, functioning as a neutral system, but the system is underpinned by humanity and we're people. And because of human behavior, we see a lot of human misbehavior. And as a result, you have people like Joseph Lister, who many people will have heard of. Certainly in Britain, he's a hero. Americans mostly know him because they recognize the name Listerine, I think. He had nothing to do with the mouthwash, but because it kills bacteria in your mouth, it seemed like a good name. So in Joseph Lister's day during the Victorian period, if you were a surgeon, your sign of being a really experienced and capable surgeon was a scalpel encrusted with blood and gore. The more encrusted your apron and your scalpel were, that's how many more surgeries you had conducted, and therefore you were a good surgeon to go to. Kid you not. They also called them, do you still call them surgery theaters in the United States?
Yes, and I know that in I think Great Britain, they're still referred to as sir or versus doctor, but here in America, surgeons are still called doctor.
Yeah, they'll say Mister if you're a cutter, but they say operating theater over here, and the word theater exists because back in the day, people would pay money to go and sit and watch someone have their arm amputated. I mean, and you can criticize that all you like, and people used to go and watch the gallows and see people executed. But I mean, really, how different is that from, you know, reality television, right? How far have we really gone? Not that far. But so Joseph Lister points out, he says, well, hey, look, I think that there's something going on where when we cut with dirty blades, and when we don't clean ourselves and we don't clean the wound, that something's going on. They didn't understand bacteria at the time, but they started using carbolic acid to kind of neutralize the bacteria, even though he didn't know about them at the time, although he was working it out as Joseph, sorry, as Louis Pasteur was doing at the same time in France. And he discovered that when you treated amputees or surgery patients with carbolic acid and cleaned the knife and used a clean apron, people were much less likely to develop postoperative infection. And what's really interesting, I mean, he demonstrated this over and over again and then published it. And he got vigorously attacked by a guy named James Simpson. James Simpson had developed anesthetic. He was a very, very talented doctor at the time. And Simpson vigorously attacked Lister, not because he had evidence that Lister was wrong, but because Simpson was developing a technique that he called acupuncture, where he would stick tiny needles around the surgery site to spread the inflammation from the surgery to distant areas away from the surgery. His notion was the reason people get postoperative infection is you get too much inflammation where you cut, and therefore you need to spread the inflammation out. He gets points for creativity. I mean, really, he was on to a great idea. He was totally wrong. Totally wrong. But he couldn't fathom the notion that Joseph Lister would beat him to the punch and demonstrate a way of defeating postoperative infection that didn't involve his technique. So James Simpson, because he didn't want to lose first place, went on the attack. And so that's why I vaguely disagree, Scott, with your statement of institutions, because it's very rarely the institution that makes the attack, it's individuals. And it's usually because we can't sit back as scientists and say, yay, the problem is solved. Someone else solved the problem I've been working at for 20 years. It's because our system gives you a huge prize if you're first. And that's the problem. We need to be rooting for team science as opposed to for team me. And because we're human, and also because we exist in a capitalistic system that kind of overruns into academia, it makes it hard for us to cheer for team us. And I talk a lot in my conclusion about how we can get around that problem by restructuring the way science is done without spending crazy amounts of money. And I think that's really pivotal for the years ahead.
So I kind of feel like there's maybe a little bit of a pattern emerging here about who gets punished for being right. Is it really a matter just of personality, politics, religion, and in this last example, ego? Are these the factors that show up again and again in your book or in the theme of who gets punished for possibly being right?
What I found most interesting was actually who gets by, even when they're putting forward an idea that is anathema to everybody else. So, parallel with Joseph Lister is Ignaz Semmelweis. He's a very poorly known Hungarian obstetrician who was so talented, he was working in Vienna. Hungary was ruled by the Habsburgs of Austria, but he ended up in Vienna and he was working with pregnant women and helping to deliver babies. And back in the day, 1 in 10 women would die shortly after childbirth, and no one knew why. They would get this horrendous infection. They would get black and blue blotches all over their pelvis. They would become so ill that they couldn't stand the pressure of sheets on their abdomen. That's how painful it was. And they would die frozen with rigid screams on their mouths 2 to 3 days later. And very few people cared. Because men didn't get the disease, only women got it. People were much more interested in smallpox and tuberculosis because men died of those diseases. And there weren't female doctors at the time. Semmelweis was special in that he really cared. He really wanted to resolve this issue. And he did resolve it by running lots and lots of experiments and keeping notes and running statistics. He was way ahead of his time in the way he was thinking about medicine as a science. And testing out his ideas and rigorously recording what worked and what didn't. And for all of his hard work, he said, folks, our hands are dirty. We're going to the morgue in the morning to dissect patients who died the previous day. We're washing with soap and water, but smell your hands. You can still smell odor of death on your hands after you wash with soap and water. There is a miasma on us. And he figured out that he could go to sewage treatment plants and get chloride of lime, which is basically the stuff we use in swimming pools. to get that foul odor of death off his hands, and that once he did that, women who he delivered babies for no longer died. And the mechanism that he had worked out was he was putting his hand inside women to feel if the baby's umbilical cord was wrapped around its neck, feel if the baby's head was presenting so they could he could rotate if needed. They were very, very good at this stuff because they tried to avoid cesareans whenever possible. Because think about it, cesarean and blood loss, 1850s, you don't want a piece of that. And so for all of his hard work, everyone else said, look, we are gentlemen. Surgeons and doctors, we are gentlemen. How dare you tell us our hands are dirty? So for all of his hard work, he got exiled and destroyed for what he found. Joseph Lister was vigorously attacked. He did retreat. He retreated to his hospital in Scotland. He stopped publishing papers for 20 years. His mechanism of dealing with all of the outcry, to teach. He sat down with student after student after student and showed them what he was doing and demonstrated that it worked. After 20 years of teaching people, because he was a very good teacher, his students, known as Listerians, spread like wildfire across England, Wales, and Scotland. And they showed in all of the hospitals what they had learned from Joseph Lister, and he really won the long game. Yes, James Simpson crushed him in the academic literature, but Lister won because of his students spreading the good word. He didn't win the fight directly. And I think we see different scientists use different techniques. Darwin was very similar to Lister. Galileo, very opposite, very gregarious, very political, and he played the long game, but in a very different manner. So I find these stories fascinating.
It's very fascinating. And by the way, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Matt Kaplan. He is The Economist, longtime science correspondent, and he has written a new book called I Told You So, Stories of Scientists Who Were Ridiculed, Sidelined, or Fired for Being Right. So I'm really interested, Matt, in knowing, you know, in these stories, you give such a great historical review of this. And it brings me to the thought of peer review. So modern day, we kind of say our layperson judgment about scientific discovery can be like, well, was it in peer-reviewed studies? And
of course,
we know also from COVID that peer-reviewed studies can still be wrong. But peer-reviewed, I mean, if your peers have big egos and they, you know, in all these instances that you've talked about, they don't want to accept the truth, what is our best form for sussing out scientific discovery and whether it's right or not?
Peer review is broken. There's no getting around it. But it is the best tool that we've got. And I think it's really, really important. And I mean, this is critical in the book, and I really lay it out, that debate and disagreement and skepticism are absolutely critical, critical to the scientific method. We must, when someone comes up with an idea that's really out there, we should question it. We have a responsibility to do so. This is everything. The big deal is to make sure the gloves don't come off. There's a difference between having seven or eight old white men walk up to the 20-something-year-old PhD student at the paleontology conference and say, gosh, that's a really interesting finding. What did you do exactly? Can you talk me through it? Are you sure? Have you replicated it yet? Hey, you know what? I've got some extra funding in my lab. I'm doubtful that this is true. I would like to help secure some funding so that you can do that again and we can be sure what you found is right. That's very different from screaming so loudly and using such profane language that the 20-something PhD student ends up sobbing to me at a restaurant an hour and a half later and quits the field.
You're kidding. Did she really?
No.
What year was that conference?
That conference, it's 2012, 2013. Okay. I put it in the book. But yeah. Here's the thing. I mean, I was talking to one of my old paleontology colleagues, and he was saying, you know, what you cite in the beginning of your book, it actually happened again in Germany the following year at the next iteration of the conference. She was there again, raising more evidence, and it went so badly that the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology group that runs the conference had to create rules of behavior, a code of conduct, so that people would start behaving themselves at the conference. And this is the issue, Lynn, because it's really, it's about making sure we're skeptical and we question and we doubt, but we do so respectfully. We do so in a polite manner, and we don't engage in character assassination. The fact that this PhD student quit the field and has never touched science again after those episodes is, I think, a critical failing of science. And this is the one that I know, right? This is the one where I was there at the conference floor. I wrote an article about it because it was about feathers. I called it quite the flap. Oh, I'm so clever, right? Economisty, dry, punny humor. So, you know, this is the one that I know. And I know so many other stories of people who are screwed by the system because people take the gloves off. And you see it in history too. Yeah. And this is the thing. We gotta make sure that we keep the behavior decent, because otherwise people leave. And that doesn't help any of us. It only helps the people who are defending the paradigms. But if the paradigms are wrong, that's a huge disservice to all of us. We should be questioning the paradigms that we all cling to. We might be wrong. And for that purpose, like Katie Carrico was saying, mRNA, it could be a potential vehicle for creating vaccines. This is really a big deal. And people said, oh, mRNA is nothing. It's been proved time and time again to be useless. It's not going anywhere. And I mean, she was just treated terribly. And it shouldn't have to be that way. We should be able to discuss, and here's the thing, here's the other side to it. And it's not just about keeping the gloves on. It's also about taking a risk. You know, I talk in the conclusion of the book about the Howard Hughes Medical Foundation versus the National Science Foundation grants. Government grants are very much a one strike and you're out sort of thing. You get funding. If you don't come up with results that support what you were saying you were going to explore, you're very unlikely to get funding again later on. Howard Hughes funding is difficult to get, but once you get it, you've got it for like 7 to 9 years. And they are very tolerant of being wrong. Howard Hughes, I mean, we got the numbers. They have way more failures than NSF grant research, way more, but they have way more massive breakthroughs than NSF grants. So if you want more research that makes teeny tiny baby steps forward and isn't wrong, NSF is a great model to go with. But tolerance of failure is critical to making the big breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. Similarly, getting ourselves out of the comfort zone, for a committee to more often say, you know what, that research sounds interesting. It's really blue sky. It's really different from what we funded before, but let's give it a shot. Let's fund that and try it. We got to do more of that. And that's where Katie Carrico's research at. She hadn't done anything wrong. Her research was really interesting, but it was blue sky kind of stuff. It was out there. And I think we need to start carving out more space in our funding sphere to go towards the stuff that is more of a risk. We have to be comfortable with failure and risk. It's critical.
Matt, we could go on and on. This is absolutely fascinating and actually driving me a little bit crazy because of this kind of two steps forward, one step back mentality we have in the scientific community. But if there's actually one lesson that you hope scientists, policymakers, even our curious listeners take away from I Told You So, what should it be?
We got to talk about the sausage making. So my newspaper, The Economist, has argued for decades that the phrase laws and sausages, you don't want to know how they're made, is outright wrong. In order to have a democracy, you must have people who understand how the levers of government function. If they don't understand how the levers of government function, they can't make educated decisions. Exactly the same rule applies to science. People must understand how science works, how it needs to function, and what needs to be done. The more educated people can be, the better off we're going to be in the long run. And so I think, I mean, this is a statement from my own newspaper. We do talk about how science works. We need to do it more. Scientists themselves need to catch themselves when they're talking to the general public and say, will my audience understand what I just said? Because if we're trying to speak jargon to make ourselves feel better, or to, you know, if we're not making an effort to be understood by people who are not scientists, then we're really failing both ourselves and them all at the same time. So we got to talk about how science works. We got to talk about it in an understandable way for people to hear.
Matt Kaplan, author of a wonderful book, I Told You So. Thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. It has been educational, enlightening, and a pleasure.
Okay, my pleasure to be here too. Thank you so much for having me, Scott.